From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1963, 50 years ago this week, Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique was published. She wrote famously of a strange stirring in a world of suburban American women. Homemakers yearning for more in life, to be empowered, employed, equal, free. The book was a bestseller, a phenom, a symbol, a rallying point. Then came decades of change. This hour on Point, The Feminine Mystique at 50 and Where American Women Stand Now. You can join the conversation. Did you read it? Did it send you to the streets, to the workplace? Women, what's the goal now, 50 years on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the voice of Betty Friedan herself, reflecting back on the problem she was writing about when she first wrote The Feminine Mystique. This is from a 1988 interview with NPR's then Bob Edwards, celebrating then the 25th anniversary of the book's publication. Betty Friedan.
As long as we were defined only as housewives, only as mothers, and never as persons, as people, we couldn't even see what our real problems were. Women were blamed for all kinds of problems, the woman problem, not getting the kitchen sink pure white, not getting the husband's shirts ironed enough, the children's bedwetting, the husband's ulcers, her own lack of orgasms. We had to break through that feminine mystique to say where we were people, and then being people, we're then entitled to equal opportunity and the rest of our American and human birthright.
Betty Friedan on the 25th anniversary. Now we're at the 50th. We have three terrific women with us today. With me in the studio, Ellen Goodman, Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the Boston Globe, mother of daughters, grandmother. She was there for those Betty Friedan days. Ellen Goodman, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much. It was great to hear Betty's voice.
Yes, brings it right straight back.
Absolutely.
With us from Northridge, California, is the great Sandy Banks, longtime columnist at the Los Angeles Times, mother of three daughters. Sandy Banks, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And joining us from New York is Noreen Malone, staff writer at the New Republic. She just read The Feminine Mystique for the first time at age 28, a new generation. Noreen Malone, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's so great to have all three of you with us. We're kind of spanning a few generations here, and very glad for that. Ellen, take us back. I don't know if you read it straight off the presses, but you remember when this book was young and what it meant and who was reading it and what it said and did.
Well, it was published when I was a senior in college, and honestly, I didn't read it for about 5 years after that, which I think was probably indicative of my feeling that just we all had to do it on our own and, you know, getting launched and coming out of college that way. And when I did finally read it, it was when, as a young reporter, I was sent out to cover the women's movement in Boston, to cover a group called Cell 16.
Take it to the streets.
Absolutely. And after that, the women's movement had begun, or what was called then the Women's Liberation Movement, had begun meeting in small places in Boston, and I actually went to cover it and then read Betty's book, which was total, polemical, and very powerful screed. And for the women who she wrote it to, it was that moment when they realized, wow, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one. And that sense of having shared stories and there being more women out there with the same feelings was a very powerful impetus to social change.
It wasn't every American woman she was writing about, not every American woman's experience.
Not at all.
And we'll talk about that. Sandy, I'm counting on you in particular there. But but it was a lot of women, and it was women who were relatively well placed. I mean, they were college educated. It was kind of her target audience. They were in suburbs where they were doing fine. She writes about women having help at home and why can't we get out of there because of that. But Ellen, for a generation that came later and maybe never read this at all, what was her complaint?
Well, some of us have now seen Mad Men again, which brings us back
to
the bad old days.
Right. Maybe that's where they'll learn.
It was very simply that women weren't treated as equals, that they weren't given the opportunities in the world to do, or they were judged very harshly if they did more than become wives and mothers. And that there was this incredible weight of society against their ability to choose other ways of life.
Would you mind reading from the very opening passage of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique? This is the very opening, 1963. It greets the world. The first run was 2,000-4,000. It eventually sold one, I don't know, almost a half a million there.
I would love to, although I'm sorry I don't have Betty's voice.
That could cut ice.
The problem lay buried, unspoken, for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to even ask of herself the silent question, is this all?
There from the very opening of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. All the shuttling and the homemaking and the kind of Leave It to Beaver stuff going on there. Sandy Banks, I want to bring it straight to you because, you know, you're looking at this from a special perspective, African-American, and remembering that a lot of women were working and they weren't sitting, you know, doing their nails and eating bonbons and making those peanut butter sandwiches in the sweet suburbs, Sandy.
Yeah, that applies to us. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and when The Feminine Mystique was published, my mother had three children and was pregnant with a fourth, and also had a job and a house to care for. And my dad worked two jobs, so she, you know, didn't have much help. And I can remember her aspiring to the very kind of life that Betty Friedan and you know other women of that class seemed to poo-poo, and that was to be able to be home and to be able to have cookies waiting when we came home and make a nice dinner that wasn't thrown together and not have to get up early on Saturday morning to do her grocery shopping while we were asleep and that kind of thing. And, you know, she had bridge clubs and she had made sure we had music classes and all that kind of thing. But the idea that she could stay home and be just a mother was kind of a fantasy. So and when I thought about this, I don't know any women of my friends, mothers of my friends, who didn't balance a job and a marriage and raising kids and keeping a home. So the concerns that were raised in The Feminine Mystique, which I have to say, and I am it sheepishly because we're on the air, yeah. I didn't read, I haven't read. I took a women's studies class in college at Ohio State, and I don't think it was one of the books that we read. When I grew up, our empowerment came from our bodies ourselves and, you know, claiming our health rights and our control over our bodies and not so much staking out a position in the workplace and that kind of thing, which we were perhaps presumed to own by then. But it just didn't apply to any women I know. Her complaints didn't resemble anything that was familiar in my life or anybody I knew.
Growing up as an African-American girl, young woman in this country. Noreen, I want to bring it to you for a new generation's view, but Ellen, just respond to that because we live in an interesting country and many things have evolved in these 50 years. Among them, many voices raised, voices like Sandy Banks and her mothers who, in 1963, the mainstream conversation could be that white suburban conversation. That certainly wasn't all of it. Martin Luther King was out there, but that's what hit the papers.
No, sure. I mean, I think Betty Friedan's book, what Sandy says, I mean, it did not talk to a whole generation of women, white and black, who were working women at that time. Mm-hmm. The irony about it not talking to black women is that Betty Friedan had been very active herself in fair housing issues. But I think that she did speak to a group that was poised to make a tremendous change in the culture. In other words, she took what was a wave and turned it into a tsunami. That this was a group of people, social change often comes from people who are in a situation of raised expectations. She originally started by with talking to her group of Smith alumni, who had been raised with great academic expectations and a sense of how intelligent they were,
and then
had the lid put on it by society, and she just popped that lid off for a very powerful group of women. And while she didn't speak to everyone by any means, she certainly did speak to an incredible number of women who went on to change their lives and who would stop her in the street and to her sometimes chagrin because she wasn't the easiest person in the world. They would say, "You changed my life," and then she would say something snarky sometimes, but also was true.
But there it was. Yeah. Norma Malone, you're 28. You've just read it. How did it read to you?
It felt really foreign to me, which I think is probably a good thing, right? That this world she described no longer felt very contemporary, that in 50 years it's changed so quickly.
What about it felt foreign, Noreen? What about it?
The idea that you would not work, that would ever cross your mind, that your highest aspiration would be to be a housewife,
Or your fate, whether you aspire to it or not.
Exactly, your fate. And it's interesting, Sandy, that you said, the women you grew up around would have aspired to that life. I see the same thing among women around my age who, for them, being a housewife is like a fantasy, right? They don't actually want to do it, but things that, Betty Friedan describes as being the worst fate imaginable, spending so much time making dinner and turning down the sheets, women now who have very high-powered jobs and are super ambitious will sort of read blogs like Design Sponge and will spend a lot of time pinning their perfect boards on Pinterest.
Yes.
But that's a choice, right? It's not something that you're forced to do, and that makes all the difference in the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the feminine mystique at 50. Feminist Betty Friedan's 1963 cry for more for women. What's changed, what hasn't, and women now? Ellen Goodman is with us, Sandy Banks at the Los Angeles Times, Noreen Malone from the New Republic. Here's a little bit from the end of the book. This is from an audio book here read by actress Parker Posey, talking about 1963, remember, about women longing to define themselves, when that was still a challenging idea given many circumstances.
It is easier to live through someone else than to become complete yourself. The freedom to lead and plan your own life is frightening if you have never faced it before. It is frightening when a woman finally realizes that there is no answer to the question, "Who am I?" except the voice inside herself.
The questioning was deep. The challenges were deep. The angst around it was deep. These days, sometimes it can be very light and flippant. Indeed, here's a little bit. This is from the pilot of NBC's 30 Rock, when Liz Lemon, played by Tina Fey, Pete Hornberger, played by Scott Adsit, first meet Jack Donaghy, played by Alec Baldwin. And Jack can quickly tell exactly what type of woman he thinks Liz Lemon is.
I don't cook very much.
Sure. I got you. New York, third wave feminist, college educated, single and pretending to be happy about it, overscheduled, undersexed. You buy any magazine that says healthy body image on the cover, and every 2 years you take up knitting for a week.
That is dead on.
There we go. From a deep movement to kind of a being set up. I mean, it's funny, Ellen. Things have evolved. Things have changed. Not everything, but a lot. And you can hold that kind of flippancy up against another kind of nostalgia.
You have to remember that change has been extremely lopsided. That there was the notion that the women's movement would walk on two legs, and with one leg you would kick down the doors that were shut to women, and nobody's nostalgic for that world. And with the other leg you would walk through those doors, transforming society for men and women. And it's the second piece of this that we haven't done. I mean, we've
which leaves Noreen's compatriots fantasizing about how things could be, maybe a little home and work.
But just think about it. Two women have defined themselves a lot more. When Betty Friedan was writing, let's remember, not only were women discriminated against, it was legal.
Down.
It was legal to discriminate against women.
Couldn't sit on juries, couldn't get a credit card without a male co-signer. Newspapers had help wanted for men
schools.
And women. Yeah.
Couldn't get jobs. I mean, my first job was at Newsweek as a researcher because women weren't allowed to write. Now, I don't want to talk, I don't want to tell people I walked 4 miles in the snow to school. We don't need that kind of nostalgia for that world. But at the same time, the thing we've never accomplished was balancing family and work. That the caregiving piece of this which Betty Friedan was saying, that can't be your whole life. That can't be all that mm-hmm. there is. Mm-hmm. But we've never figured out a way, or we haven't yet figured out a way, to balance family and work, to be have both of those parts in our life without going completely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the presenting problem for the next generation. Only it's not just that we have problem caring for our children. We now are not only working mothers, we're also working daughters. So the caregiving
right,
goes
ways.
Across the age spectrum, and that still remains a subject very dear to women's hearts that hasn't been resolved.
Sandy, how do you see that today? I want to bring it to you, Noreen. It's your generation who will walk into that one or is in it right now. But Sandy, even if your mother's experience as an African-American mom who was working, who was not sitting at home, as different as it was, there are issues of freedom here, equality, humanity in trying to resolve these family issues. How do you look at that impulse today, Sandy, for women, you know, the full bouquet of American women?
Well, you know, I think Ellen made a really good point about Betty Friedan kind of blowing the lid off or launching a movement that kind of blew the lid off some things. And those, the change in political views and public views of women affected all women. It helped my mother. It helped me. And it's helping my daughter. So it's kind of, I think of it sometimes in terms of W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the talented 10th, which is kind of the leaders, the most educated, the people with the highest expectations will lead the movement, and that will benefit everyone. And that is what happened. And so I think we all owe a debt to this kind of consciousness raising, even if, you know, it didn't include me or it didn't include people like me. I think it helped all of us. And I think it, you know, we've evolved from just being at home and being a mom isn't enough and I want more to when my children were young, and my oldest is 27, it was almost shameful to be a housewife. And women talked about, some of my neighbors talked about being embarrassed when people said, what do you do? And they mm-hmm. had to say, well, I'm a mom. And now I think we've gotten to a point where we do have, as Noreen said, choice, you know, and you know, my daughters don't even think about that they have to, that they can only have one or the other. They presume that they will be able to balance work and a family and a marriage, or not a marriage. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not sure how realistic that is trying to do it for the last 20 years. But I think the idea that some of the cultural, imperatives kind of what you have to do have fallen. And I think that's one of the best things to have come of all of this is that we have gotten to a point where we can choose our terms, and they are not going to be easy, and it's going to be complicated. And I don't know, you know, as Ellen said about resolving this issue, this conflict, you know, how mm-hmm. to manage child rearing and working and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we can ever do that. I think at some point we're going to realize we cannot have it all. I think the workplace has to become more accommodating, and it is on some levels for some women. But as a culture, we have to value child rearing and women in ways that make it easier and more comfortable. But we have come a long way, and the feminine mystique kind of pulled the covers off issues for a whole country in ways that benefited us all and that my daughters are benefiting from now.
Noreen, speak to that. You've said, I mean, your own mom, I think, was one of these educated women who stayed home. And you've said the third wave feminist in you loves that and found no small part of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique very harsh.
Well, I was coming to this book from having sort of marinated in the feminist blogosphere, which can be a place of harsh judgment now, even though, you know, we do have a choice whether to work or not. The sort of mommy wars that are constantly being fought can be, you know, sort of scarring, right? Even if you're mm-hmm. not a mother, as I'm not. And so when I read this, it was a polemic, right? Which she had sure. to write it in a polemical fashion. But, you know, to someone who is coming from a different world, it reads as a harsh indictment, you know, doesn't sort of give full credence to the work that women who, you know, spend some time inside the home were doing. But to your point about making it easier for people to balance work and family. I don't think that's going to change until it becomes recognized as not just a woman's problem, right?
Yes.
Until it becomes something of import to men as well. And I think we're starting to move in that direction a little bit. There are more men who are stay-at-home dads. There are more men who are sharing equally or partially in the childcare duties. And that, you know, that change is going to be incremental, but it's going to make a difference. People who are signing laws into effect and who are making the workplace policies at companies, those are men and women. And they, you know, if it's not foremost in a man's mind, it's never going to get done.
Ellen, I want to come to you on that, but we have so many callers. Let me get a few. Prattville, Alabama. Tristan is calling. Hi, Tristan. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Hi.
I was just calling because I wanted to say thank you to these amazing women. I served in the United States Army for several years. I deployed to Iraq. My husband is still serving, and they afforded me the opportunity to serve alongside men. And there's still challenges, and we're still working for equal rights in the armed services, but it's amazing. And I appreciate everything that has been done for me as a woman in this country.
How old are you, if I may ask, Tristan?
I'm 33.
Are you an officer?
I was, yes.
That's a long way from Betty Friedan's home in the kitchen. And you feel a debt of gratitude, you're saying, for that open road.
I do, yes.
Ellen, talk about it. Talk about a change. Talk about a distance traveled.
That's true. You know, it's so interesting because when Betty Friedan and many of us supported the Equal Rights Amendment, it was opposed on the grounds that, oh, God, women would be in the military and we'd have single-sex toilets. Do you remember this argument?
Bingo.
And by the way, we have single-sex toilets, women in the military, and no Equal Rights Amendment. But I want to respond to what Noreen said, which is that about men. And I was about to say the same thing because the critical thing that's happened is that we also have a generation of young men who also want to balance work and family. And it's at least as hard for them to be accepted for that larger sense of what constitutes a life to be accepted for men. And Betty Friedan really didn't talk much about that in this opening salvo of the women's movement.
I mean, people talk about how women have moved into what used to be called men's roles in the workplace. Have men moved into women's roles?
In many places, men are moving into what used to
quote
be defined as women's roles. There's certainly a lot more men in various parts of healthcare that used to be reserved for women. And I think in this new economy where everybody's scrambling for a whole set of new jobs that don't have a gender label over them.
Yeah. Alice in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Tristan in Prattville, thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. Alice in Gloucester, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling because I feel when you talk about feminine mystique, I feel as though you're talking about me. Because even though there are choices, I feel as though I don't have a choice because my husband's job makes more money than mine would. And even though we are educated at the same institution, we have essentially the same degree, he gets paid more than I do for whatever job I could get. And so I am stuck at home, and I don't feel as though I'm liberated.
Do you feel like the unrealized woman that Betty Friedan wrote about because of that?
I do, because, and I have a lot of friends that are in the same position as I am. Their husband's job makes more money than they do. I don't have a job that I can get where one of us will have to stay home and take care of my child if she is sick. We can't put his job at risk, so my job would be the one at risk. And I actually had a job, and I had to quit it because my child was sick often.
Yeah.
And I kept on having to call out.
So there's still the frustration, even now. I mean, we know it's whatever it is now, 78 cents on the dollar nationally, though in particular circumstances that gap can be bigger. I mean, Noreen, what about it? There's Alice testifying to the reality she feels, that she still has to be the one at home. She doesn't have that full range of options. And yet an awful lot of women have marched into, you name it. I mean, the medical, doctors, lawyers, all over, Noreen.
Right. Well, what she described, having to quit a job because of having to take time off to deal with children, that means that the culture still hasn't changed, right? Like, we can talk all we want about FLMA laws and legislating from the top down, but in a workplace, you need to have the understanding that, you know, a person is more than just someone punching a time card, and that, yeah, sometimes one of the partners in a marriage is going to have to go home and take care of the kids. And, you know, for whatever reason, it might be the woman more often than not. And you know, if the company's workplace can learn to accommodate that, we'd be in a much better place.
Sandy, think with us for just a second about power at home, at the office. What's your sense of how that equation has changed, how much it's changed, where women really stand now in the gender equation on power today?
Oh, that's a good question, Tom. And I think my thought in response to the caller kind of went more emotionally to power in a relationship, mm-hmm. and power in a marriage. And, you know, for me, my husband died years ago when my children were very small, so I was a single mother. So whatever sick kid or whatever, you know, had to be taken care of.
It was on you.
Kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I remember us negotiating when they were small about who, we both had careers and we both had, you know, careers we valued. So who has to stay home and who has to pick up this kid and who has to do this? And it was often kind of a difficult conversation and, you know, mm-hmm. a yelling conversation. But I think the work that men have to insist on their own rights to be at home with their kids when it's needed, and that men have to take that. It's kind of what Noreen said, you know, until the men say, hey, this is what we want to do. Mm-hmm. They have to take that battle to their employer in kind of, you know, both because it's what they should do as a father and because this is something that's important to my wife and she ought to have the freedom as I have to pursue a career that suits her and satisfies her. Now, it's not ever going to, I don't think, be equal. And you know, my experience has just been that mother carries its own weight, and it carries, you know,
on the home front. Mm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I do think that in terms of the workplace, until men say, you know, I need to take this morning off to be with my kid because I have to take her to the doctor, until they're willing to do that instead of saying, well, it's going to be bad for my career,
yeah.
so you have to do it, then things aren't going to change.
I do see more men doing that, though. Maybe it's still not in a one-to-one. Ellen, I want to bring the same power question to you. I mean, I've known you a long time. You're no shrinking violet. But eye-to-eye with males, women today, do you think the interior life has changed in such a way that there is equality in that, you know, eye-to-eye sort of exchange? Who's
well,
got the power
here? There's a continuum. I mean, but I think the thing that has happened is that young people enter a marriage expecting equality. Mm-hmm. And when that push come to shove moment comes, often with childcare, often with children, mm-hmm. that puts a real, that's puts many young couples in a place they didn't expect to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts a tremendous strain on renegotiating relationships and figuring out. If they live in a way that they don't sort of mentally agree with, so that they're thrown back into much more traditional roles, it can put a tremendous strain on the relationship. So it's better to hang in there and negotiate than to get into a place where the relationship is gone. I also want to respond to the economic costs, because while in the short term our caller said she wasn't earning as much as her husband, mm-hmm. and so she felt her job had to be the one
at
to
home.
Go, there's a long-term cost of that for her and for her family. Because the short term that she's describing for, you know, however long,
6-7 years, whatever, more maybe,
that cost in terms of real dollars can be amazing.
We'll look at that.
Can
and
I
more.
Throw in one other thing?
Let me hold it after
okay,
a break. It's right
sure.
in front of us here. Ellen Goodman, great to have you here. Sandy Banks, Noreen Malone. We're talking about the feminine mystique at 50. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the feminine mystique at 50. Feminist Betty Friedan's 1963 cry for more for women, looking at what's changed, what hasn't, and women and their position in American society now. Ellen Goodman is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning longtime columnist for the Boston Globe. Sandy Banks is here, a great columnist for the Los Angeles Times, joining us from Northridge, California. And Noreen Malone is here, staff writer at the New Republic, joining us from New York, 28 years old, on the front end of the experience. Lots of feedback from our listeners online here on Facebook. Nancy writes, the angst of having all this fire inside with desires to explore, to study, to have the same opportunity your husband has, but being home to raise your own children is something many women understand. She says, we women still struggle, still pay the price for not being men, although it is improving. Trudy says, doing it all, she says, now we women are expected to do it all. We have to work and be the perfect wife. And I would like, Trudy writes on the web, to be able to have one job, just one job. Johanna writes, what's interesting is that 50 years later, I find myself recommending this book to women I know who are stay-at-home mothers. More than one says they feel they need antidepressants to get through the days and years of deferring their own dreams for the sake of their family. It can be a fantasy to do it. It can be dreams deferred to do it. Ellen, you had a point just before the break, and I had to come in there.
Well, we can move on to this point, too, because, you know, Freud, who was one of the people that Betty Friedan took on head on,
yes.
But nevertheless, he said that what makes a happy life is work and love, two parts. And I think that most people feel that at some level, some meaningful work and some love and relationships are what make for a whole. What I was going to say before is that I think one of the great changes, and as the oldest member of this trio of us, is that the discovery, particularly on the part of men who become sons as well, mm-hmm. that the caregiving piece goes all the way through life. So that we're talking about raising children. But we have now experiencing with the longevity revolution, caregiving of our elders. Mm-hmm. And that is something that husbands, fathers, sons are experiencing almost, not quite, mm-hmm. as much as the women in their lives. And that piece of it means that it never ends, and the workplace has to accommodate caregiving at all stages of life.
I mean, Noreen, you're 28. Among your peers, friends, sort of visualizing the ideal, you know, in terms of power, role, place at home and work and beyond. How do you and your friends look at what you may see as the status quo out there these days, and how inviting or uninviting it is, fair or unfair it is?
I think most of my peers have the expectation that marriage will be 50-50, which people who have actually been married will often say, well, that's good luck to you in that ideal.
It's a good target.
It is a good target. It is a good target. And I do think that for the vast majority of people in my cohort, that is the ideal. Hannah Rosen, who has written this book, The End of Men, talks a lot about the seesaw marriage, which is a setup in which first one partner gets to concentrate on his or her career and the other partner sort of, you know, picks up the slack more at home and in their personal life. And then the other partner gets a turn. And so maybe that's a different way to sort of negotiate the realities of a demanding workplace and a demanding home life.
Maybe. Lauren in Petersham, Massachusetts. Lauren, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I was really moved by this whole conversation about parenting. Mm-hmm. And I feel like parenting is often relegated to a second-class position in society. And I think our children are suffering. I work with kids enough to see that the presence of a parent, there's nothing greater than the presence of a parent. And I know that's not possible for all people. And at the same time, I guess if society gave it a higher role and a higher calling and saw it as a career position, if you will, there's so much work that can be done within oneself and within the self-reflection of parenting, whether a father or a mother stays home. So just wanted to make that point. And I feel like kids across the nation, as a result of kind of this not being a priority or seen as a priority culturally, I know that it's created by a culture.
Yeah, Lauren, I'm so glad you raise it. I mean, Sandy Banks, what about this criticism? And it has come for some time that, yes, women have gone out and become more fully realized, but there's a price and children pay it. I mean, we're all struggling with that one way or another in this conversation, but what about that concern, Sandy?
Well,
Well, I'm really glad she raised it, because I think it is really important and central to this conversation. And you know, when we talk about the women that have kind of, women that I know and even younger women that have the fantasy of being at home, it's not being at home so you can turn down the sheets or have a neater home or shinier floors. It's being home more so that you can be with your children. And I think that the children did kind of get lost in a lot of this discussion about, you know, do I want to be fulfilled as a human being, and then that means I have this wonderful career. And I think that there is something also, you know, very fulfilling about raising strong, healthy children. And the conversation when my children were growing up that I had with women in my cohort in the newsroom was always, how do you carve out a little bit more time? And that means staying up at 2 o'clock to bake the cupcakes for the bake sale the next day. It means cheating and saying something or pretending an assignment ran long so that you can go catch the soccer game. And, you know, it means, you know, cutting out a lot of things so that you can be there. And I think that she's right in that. And that, being able to be attentive and attend to our children is going to have to only come when culturally we value mothering as much as we value careering and, you know, the other important parts of a woman's life. And it is very difficult now, and I think the children do suffer. And it's interesting, you know, I cannot imagine, I have to say, being home all day and not having a career. And I can remember being very, very happy when I'd come home at the end of the day and see my daughter very happy with the babysitter and thinking, thank God for this woman, you know, because I could not have amused her all day,
yeah,
kept her happy. But I also knew as they got older that they needed me even more. You know, the lunacy of thinking, well, I'll just stay home for the first couple of years and I'll go back to work. You know, they need you to be there when they're 13 and they're wrestling, yeah, with, do I smoke pot? You know, yeah, that's when they need to have somebody there to talk to, mom or dad, somebody. I do think as a culture, we have to accept that and grapple with it better.
Ellen, how has your thinking on this evolved over these decades? I mean, there was straight up injustice when this book came out, and for a long time before and after. At the same time, here's this reality. We are organic creatures, and we procreate and reproduce and have to nurture, and no saying that should be all on women, and yet here we are. How do you see the reality of child-rearing, family-raising, and women's empowerement? How's it work?
I see the younger generation. I'm a grandmother now, and I see them, everybody struggling just in the way that Sandy described, with trying to do work which is important and meaningful and supportive to them, at the same time being there and attentive and caring for their children, who are my grandchildren. You know, there's nobody in the world I care more about.
But can you do it all? Or sometimes I look around, I mean, I see my kids coming up, I feel guilty, because as a society, we tore the lid off for women somewhat, but we haven't changed more than that to make it humane.
You know,
we just march people out and say, go and do it. But is it possible to do it the way it's set up, to do it right the way it's set up now?
That's why change has been lopsided. That, in fact, we have allowed more women to move towards what we used to praise as male success and independence, then we have allowed the whole culture to move in the direction of caregiving and flexibility and making that possible. That's the next phase of this work. You look at what Obama talked about during the State of the Union address. He's talking about preschool care. Well, I remember when, let us not forget, Richard Nixon tried to get that through in 1972.
Yeah.
And 30 years later, we're still, or did I say 40 years later, we are still trying to get the support for family and for flexibility and for being able to do these things well that we were looking for back then. So that is the that's the legacy. I'm sorry to tell Noreen, that is my generation's legacy to yours.
Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks
you're
a
welcome.
Lot. Anissa in Tullahoma, Tennessee. Anissa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I was just saying, I'm a physician. I'm in a very busy nephrology practice.
Mm-hmm.
My husband teaches chemistry at a local junior college here, mm-hmm. and I obviously make several times what he makes. Mm-hmm. When we first met, he was doing his post-bac, and I helped support him through that. I've been a physician since we met.
Okay.
And just coming through grad school and now with him teaching, it's been a real struggle trying to find a balance,
no,
not just
no doubt.
For us financially. He's sort of knew going into this that I was going to be the breadwinner, but also in terms of what we're talking about in terms of child care, I think he really came into the relationship thinking that he wanted to be 50-50, but the logistics of that have been really challenging. And there are still times that now, 8 years into our marriage, you know, when I come home and, you know, I say, well, you've got to help me with this, or do you realize that you're walking away when I'm walking
yeah,
in the
yeah,
door?
Right.
But that, yeah, there's always a little bit of a give. And
so, doctor, what do you learn from this, Dr. Anissa? What's your takeaway from this? What's the target? What's the right frontier, the goal here?
It's a challenge, and I think it's a challenge that every couple has to attack on their own. For the individual couple, for us, there was no question that I was going to work and that I was going to work full time. So, you know, the next question was, well, where are you going to fit in and how is your career going to fit in? And after spending 8 years in his PhD, mm-hmm. even though financially right now, it would be more beneficial for him to stay home than for us to hire a nanny to stay with the kids. His income barely covers what we pay the nanny.
Yeah.
But in terms of our long-term financial situation, he has a good point. If I'm out of the workforce for so many years, this is going to be much more difficult for me to ever go back into academics after taking several years off. So it's been a balance. We've found a wonderful nanny who's part of our family, and I think that allows me a little less guilt. As a woman, you're always going to have guilt. I always tell this to, you know, people who are coming up, to women in particular, who are coming up through medical school and residency. You're always going to have guilt. You could always spend more time at home. You could always spend more time at work. But in my own personal life and my approach, some days really wish I could spend more time with my kids,
yeah.
But every day come home feeling really good about what I've accomplished over the course of the day. And my kids see that in me. And I feel that I'm a role model for them and a role model for younger kids coming up. I've been talking to my son's kindergarten teacher about coming in and giving a talk.
And you'll be the doctor sitting before that class, and that is something not entirely but quite different from what Betty Friedan would have seen 50 years ago. Anissa, I appreciate your call, but Sandy, as you're listening to that, I'm thinking, I mean, that balancing act is so difficult, so challenging, and yet there's always a class issue in here. Anissa, with her success, can have a nanny who makes about as much as her PhD husband to come in and help them with this balancing act. A lot of American families, couples, single moms, don't have that option, Sandy. Where's that put gender equality?
I think you're right, and again, it still requires, though, as she said, the negotiation in
yes.
a family, and mm-hmm. unless you're a single mother, you know, as I was, when it's going to all fall on you. But having good quality child care is another big part of this, and also developing a network of friends. I mean, just as Betty Friedan in the Feminine Mystique talked about, you know, the collective force of women, it's really important for women now to not let that part of our lives go and to have people that you can call on to say, I can't get to daycare in time. Can you possibly go?
Mm-hmm.
Or have, you know, another mom. I mean, I, you know, had always had mothers that were willing to help me bring the kids home, or she can come to my house after school, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that beyond, you know, negotiating in a relationship, and that kind of the thing that Noreen talked about, the lopsided progress, is really important. That I worked really, really hard for 10 years when we got married before we had kids, because I knew I wanted to be able to take time off when we had kids. And my
mm-hmm.
husband wanted kids desperately, and I kept saying, we got to wait, because I wanted my career to be stable enough
yeah.
that I could take time off and not hurt it. And working class women don't always have those options, and that's where your social circle has to help. Your marriage is a part of that, but the biggest part has to be societally that we respect the role of mothers and don't make it so hard.
Let me get one more call here. Nina in Somerset, Kentucky. Nina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm so happy that I got to call right now,
sure.
just after what your speaker said,
mm-hmm.
because I feel that women should be respected for whatever choice they make. If they choose to be stay-at-home moms, if they choose to be working moms, one of the things that hasn't changed, and a lot of things haven't changed, is that if a woman chooses not to have children,
mm-hmm.
as I did,
mm-hmm.
they are looked upon with suspicion, askance, pity.
What are you up to, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and why would you be so selfish to make that choice? In fact, you don't admit freely that you made that choice. that it isn't an accident
right.
that you are child-free, which is the phrase that became popular at one time, rather than childless. I was lucky enough to be at a speech that Betty Friedan gave in a tiny little bank conference room when I was in my early 20s.
Yeah.
Some of us were excited, some were appalled. I was one of the excited ones, but I wanted that family and that suburb life, and so I was a little bit of a late bloomer going back to college in my 30s. I think the point I'm trying to make is I was excited then. I just recently downloaded her book to my Kindle to reread, and I'm still excited. And I'm so proud of some of the young women I see who are doing such fabulous things a little more easily, I think, than women of my age were able to do, or the choices we had to make.
A little, I should say, and Betty Friedan, no small credit for that. Nina, I appreciate your call so much. Ellen, here we are, 50 years on, and these debates go on and on. The challenges go on. I guess the need to keep turning this to look for the best or the better way is just never ends.
Well, the classic sociologist line is that the only way to solve the disruption that comes from change is with more change.
Yeah, on and on we go. Noreen, that's you. You're 28. What do you think? In your lifetime, does this get figured out, or is this perpetual, this tension?
It's never going to get figured out, but we're starting from a much better place than we were 50 years ago, so I'm really hopeful.
Well, we will look with great interest at how your generation unfolds this thing. And we're so grateful to you for being with us today. Noreen Malone, staff writer at The New Republic, thank you very much for joining us, and good luck, Noreen.
Thank you.
Sandy Banks at the Los Angeles Times in Northridge, California today. Sandy, always love having you here. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ellen Goodman, I've watched you through many of these battles. It's been something to see. It feels good, though, to be here today, sitting and being able to look with the accomplishment that is there. It is far from inconsequential.
That's right. And I've got to say that Betty Friedan really did give a kickstart whole change.
Ellen, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.